This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Actors Paul Muni, John Garfield, Zero Mostel, and Walter Matthau, the acting teachers Lee Strasberg and Sanford Meisner, and director Sidney Lumet were all associated with Yiddish theater early in their careers. Yiddish theater was written and performed by and for Yiddish-speaking Jews, largely in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. It originated in Eastern Europe. Its capital in America was the Lower East Side of Manhattan, where many Jewish immigrants lived. The Yiddish theater altered the history of Broadway and Hollywood, and thus, to a certain extent, America, writes Stefan Kanfer in his new book, Stardust Lost, The Triumph, Tragedy, and Mishegas of the Yiddish Theater in America. Kanfer is also the author of books about Groucho Marx and the summer resorts of the Catskill Mountains. Kanfer has a personal connection to the Yiddish theater. The town that your grandfather was from, Iași, Romania, you described that as the place where Yiddish theater actually started. I didn't realize you could actually trace Yiddish theater to, like, one town.
That's right. You know, nobody knows how the Greek theater began or who its father was or even how the Shakespearean Elizabethan theater started. But we know that the Yiddish theater began in a wine cellar in Iași, Romania, with a play by a man named Abraham Goldfaden, who really was sort of the George Washington of the Yiddish theater.
And so tell us about that first play.
Well, it was what he later described as a hodgepodge. He was a man who anticipated Irving Berlin by 50 years in that he couldn't read or write a note, but he could sound notes out on the piano and somebody would transcribe them. He wrote lyrics. He also wrote the books for these shows. And although they are none of them very memorable at first, they enchanted an audience who had never seen theater before. Jews were not really welcomed, certainly not in the Russian theater. And besides, the rabbis frowned upon such theater as, quote, frivolous.
So there hadn't been Yiddish theater before this play. Like, why not? I mean, there's theater all over the world. Why wasn't there Yiddish theater?
Well, before 1876, which was when it began, we really had a kind of restrictions on the Jews. Certainly, Tsar Nicholas didn't, the Romanovs in general, didn't want Jews around. They certainly didn't want them in the cities, so they were largely in what's called the Pale, these settlements far beyond the places of urbanity where theater thrived. And the Jews of France and Germany and places where they were, a little less restrictions. There were also traditions of the Jewish traditions, which didn't allow or didn't welcome Jews in theater. They felt that a Jew would become too assimilated too quickly. That was not what they wanted. They wanted Jews to remain Jews, and they would be polluted by what was called the Haskalah, the Enlightenment. But of course, there was no holding back the Enlightenment. The rabbis were King Canute in that regard, and sooner or later it had to happen. And it happened in a fairly liberal country, which Romania was then, and in a very liberal city, which was Iași.
So how did Yiddish theater spread after that first play in Iași, Romania?
It's a wonderful question because it was almost as if it were a fire waiting to be ignited. What happened was the word of mouth was so extraordinary that people began to pile into these little wine cellars, and then suddenly everyone wanted to be an actor. There were no academies for Jews who wanted to study acting, so they just invented the form of acting. They invented songs, they invented stories, they invented playwrights, and they developed the theater out of nothing almost overnight, so that by the late 19th century, it was blooming in Russia, even though there were restrictions against it, and in France, and in England, and eventually when the pogroms began to be very heavy and torturous, the Jews arrived in New York, as we know, by the millions by the time the immigration was over. And since you cannot have a great theater without a great audience, they formed that great audience.
Then the Yiddish theater came to the United States as Jewish immigrants came to the United States and became very popular.
Yes.
in Manhattan in particular. What were some of the early narratives of the Yiddish plays in the early part of Yiddish theater in New York?
Well, believe it or not, they adored great plays. So they tried to adapt Tolstoy, and they even adapted Hamlet. And there's a wonderful story that goes along with that. Boris Tomaszewski, who is the grandfather of Michael Tilson Thomas, the conductor, was a sort of a rotund, very self-involved impresario actor. Thought the world of himself, and of course the women were crazy about him. He cut a fine figure of two men, I like to say. But in any case, he decided that he was going to do Shakespeare. He did Hamlet, probably the fattest Hamlet that ever was, and it was adored by the audience. And they applauded at opening night. And then they called, "Author, author." He was mortified because he didn't know what to do, and his wife, Bessie, pointed to one of the actors and said, "You go out and say you're Mr. Shakespeare." They spelled it S-H-E-K-S-P-I-R. Shakespeare. "You go out and say you're Mr. Shakespeare." And the actor wouldn't do it. So she came to the apron of the stage and she said, "Mr. Shakespeare lives a long way from here in London, but he's very grateful for your response." Anyway, that's the kind of theater that they had. It was originally theater, borrowed theater from other sources, and gradually they began to develop their own playwrights, some of them hacks and some of them quite brilliant.
Now, you make a distinction between the more ambitious plays and socially relevant plays in the Yiddish theater and the stuff that you describe as shund, which is Yiddish for trash. What were some of the differences between the two?
Well, they used to shoehorn songs into everything, including King Lear. There's a wonderful site. It's a true story. There's a wonderful site that Brown University has. They have all of the Yiddish theater song sheets, and they're quite beautiful, but you see that they had songs for Tolstoy's Resurrection, for example. They just shoehorned it in there. And so that even serious theater for a while had touches of shund, but the real shund was kind of vaudeville. It was, the couple meet, the couple break up, the couple finally wed under the canopy, that sort of thing with songs and stories. Whereas the real theater, with playwrights like Jacob Gordon, really discussed the hard life of Jews in the old world and then in the new world, the idea of the sweatshop, the idea of social justice, which was always burning hard in the Lower East Side, became the subject matter of many a play.
Now, some actors were unhappy having to do the more formulaic kind of Yiddish theater, and you describe in particular David Kessler, and you quote him as saying, "All day long, I am a human being. I speak like a human being, act like a human being. At night, I must dress myself like a turkey, like an idiot. If I went out in the street like this, people would throw stones at me for a lunatic." Yes. Here in the theater, they shout, "Bravo." So,
well, there were three great actors. He was one of them. Kessler was a very important actor because he was a naturalist. He did not go for the breast beating and the forehead wiping that you see in so much Yiddish theater, and indeed you saw it at that point uptown in Broadway as well. He was a very serious guy, died in his middle years and left almost nothing behind. He didn't have children, so he is almost forgotten now. The second one, these are all spiritual sons really of the founder, and they're important on their own, but they would not really have happened without Abraham Goldfaden. The second is Jacob Adler, and Jacob Adler is the father of Stella Adler, the great acting teacher who taught Marlon Brando and Robert De Niro and Melanie Griffith and many, many others. And Jacob Adler was so powerful an actor that when he played Shylock, which is, after all, Shakespeare's most anti-Semitic creation, it was a tremendous sensation, not only on the Lower East Side, but a producer named Daniel Frohman came down and said, "Mr. Adler, I'd like to take this to Broadway." And Adler said, "Look, I know what I sound like when I speak English. I have a strong Yiddish accent. I'll sound like a vaudevillian and a comedian, and I'm not going to do it." And Frohman said, "You misunderstand me, Mr. Adler. You will play in Yiddish, and everyone else will play in English." And that's exactly what happened. If you can imagine such a thing happening on Broadway today, Shylock was played in Yiddish, and The Merchant of Venice, the rest of it was played by English-speaking actors speaking Elizabethan English. The third was Boris Tomaszewski, whom I've described before, but Tomaszewski was important because he got things on. He knew how to raise money. He was like Hal Prince. He just knew how to find the theater and make the presentation, and was very, very popular for a long, long time. Died broke, of course, as they tend to do.
No, I want to get back to the actor David Kessler, and he's the one who said, you know, that basically that if he looked and behaved on the street the way he did on stage, people would think he was a lunatic, but he's applauded for this on stage. He wanted to do a more naturalistic form of acting. In order to do that, he needed to find a playwright who could write plays that kind of more naturalistic acting would be suitable for. And he did find someone. Who did he find?
Well, Jacob Gordon was a more than great playwright. He was somebody who was a pioneer. He's almost forgotten now. But if you go back and you look at those plays, and I've looked at many of them, they have a sincerity and a very direct reach to the audience. They don't plead for sympathy. He's very realistic about how he handles characters. And you could see that Kester would fall in love with this kind of dialogue. On the other hand, most of the audience didn't want to see naturalistic drama. They wanted to see the exaggerated form. Franz Kafka, who was a great Yiddish theater fan in Prague, loved the exaggerated performances. He said, one must aim high to hit the mark. And they really loved that. But Kessler was well ahead of his time in demanding believability. The others kind of hammed it up, particularly Chomyshevsky, or Pastrami did it up, I guess you'd say. But he was just somebody that had the shop girls in his corner. And Kessler never was popular. I mean, he was certainly highly regarded and respected, but he never gained the popularity that Chomyshevsky did because he played to the galleries.
In writing about the Yiddish theater, you write a bit about Sholem Aleichem, who wrote a lot of Yiddish plays and short stories. In fact, Fiddler on the Roof is based on one of his stories, Tevye the Milkman. And you quote a letter, you excerpt a letter that Sholem Aleichem, which was a pen name, by the way, wrote to the actor Jacob Adler, trying to convince him to do a Tevye story on stage. Would you read an excerpt of that letter for us?
Yes, because I think it gives a great picture of what was going on the stage at that point. It begins, "Great master of the stage, in my play you will find none of the effects on which the Jewish public has for so many years been nourished. You will find no soul-tearing scenes, no corpses in cribs, no demented women, no patriotic songs or nationalistic speeches, no transient boarders seducing innocent maidens, and no vulgar jokes. You will only find a simple Jew, father of five daughters, an honest, clean, wholesome, and greatly suffering character who, with all his misfortunes, will make the public laugh from beginning to end." Of course, he was right. That was Tevye that he's describing. But it took another 50 years before that Tevye was acceptable to the American public.
My guest is Stefan Kanfer. His new book about the Yiddish theater is called Stardust Lost. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Stefan Kanfer. His new book is called Stardust Lost, The Triumph, Tragedy, and Mishigas of the Yiddish Theater in America. You know, you've been talking a little bit about some of the friction within the Yiddish theater about, you know, more serious and realistic plays versus more formula, overacting, hyper-emotional kinds of things. There was also, apparently, some friction between Yiddish theater and vaudeville. From how you describe it, it sounds like a lot of people on the Yiddish stage really look down on vaudeville.
Well, I think that's been the case with Uptown as well. I think vaudeville is a place where amateurs get started. And in those days, that was the training ground for people who wanted to get into theater or wanted to get in at some point into a higher show business, play two a day at the Palace Theater, for example. But it was not legitimate. And the Yiddish theater snobs that they were decided that legitimate was better than vaudeville and that you could have an Eddie Cantor, but you couldn't have a Jacob Adler on the same stage. So there was that. And they also found in vaudeville a kind of cheap, easygoing anti-Semitism. And, you know, there's a CD that's come out fairly recently called Jewface. And it plays a lot of those old playing around anti-Semitic kind of songs that were very popular on the stage. And the Yiddish theater actors were appalled by this. They took themselves seriously. They took their crowds seriously. Often the audience was more religious than the actors, but they respected the religion and they respected the idea of culture, a high culture, and they thought vaudeville, I think quite correctly, was a lower down kind of entertainment.
Yeah, and the CD you mentioned, Jewface, which is a CD of Jewish ethnic comic recordings and songs from the early part of the 20th century, we'll actually be speaking later in the show to the person who put that CD together.
Well, one of the songs is called Cohen Owes Me $97, and it's by Irving Berlin, who came from a Yiddish-speaking family and certainly was influenced by a lot of the Yiddish theater, but decided to go the other way. Gershwin was another one. George Gershwin was offered a job playing music in the Yiddish theater and composing for the Yiddish theater for Boris Tomaszewski, and Tomaszewski decided Gershwin wasn't good enough. And Gershwin thereafter used to meet Sholem Secunda, who wrote By Mir Bist Du Schön, and stayed all his life in the Yiddish theater as a composer. And he kept shaking his hand saying, thank you. If I hadn't been kicked out that day, I'd be a composer for the Yiddish theater. That's all I'd be.
Well, it's nice to live in a time where you can embrace both. You know, you can embrace, you know, the higher aspirations of the Yiddish theater and the just kind of like fun and talent of vaudeville. You don't have to choose.
It's true. It's true. But vaudeville lasted a lot longer than the Yiddish theater, in fact.
Yeah, I guess that's true. And a lot of the vaudeville stars kind of made it to movies and television. And
there's only been a couple of crossover stars, from the Yiddish theater. One of them was Paul Muni, of course. It was Muni Weisenfreund. And was a superstar in the Yiddish theater before he became an actor for the American stage and for films and an Academy Award winner and so on. And then there's people like Molly Picon, whom people remember because she was in Fiddler on the Roof. And there are very few others. Walter Matthau began as a kid. Sidney Lumet, the director, began acting as a kid and then switched over. Very, very few. The Yiddish theater was rather exclusive in its way.
You know, you mentioned that very few of the stars of Yiddish theater actually crossed over to the English stage or to, you know, to American movies. But the Yiddish theater did have quite an impact on American theater and film. And you quote Marlon Brando, who studied with Stella Adler, who was the daughter of the great Yiddish actor Jacob Adler. And Brando said, if there wasn't the Yiddish theater, there wouldn't have been Stella Adler. And if there hadn't been Stella Adler, there wouldn't have been all those actors who studied with her and changed the face of theater, and not only acting, but directing and writing.
That's true. I think she, you know, she said that she had only worked with two geniuses in her life for the stage, and one of them was her father and the other was Brando. I think there are many, many stories about the two of them. One, she was teaching a class and she said, okay, your problem now, you're all chickens. And a bomb is about to hit. And you know, and do whatever you think is right. They would go around screeching and hysterically clucking. And Brando just stayed there, sitting there, pretending that he was hatching an egg. And she said, why are you doing this? And he said, I'm a chicken. What the hell do I know about bombs? You know, she knew she had somebody lively right there. I think she was a powerful influence, as was Lee Strasberg. They, of course, the two hated each other, but they both had seen Yiddish theater, and they knew there was something holy about the way the serious Jewish actors treated the theater, and they wanted to bring that into the life of the American actor. And also they wanted to take the most realistic kinds of human problems and bring them on the stage. I mean, to me, there's no doubt that Arthur Miller wrote Death of a Salesman with Jews in mind, and he allowed Joseph Bulhoff to do it in Yiddish. And when it was done in Yiddish, most people felt that was the original and that then somebody else had translated it into English because it played so true to the familial conflicts of the period.
How else would you describe the impact that Yiddish theater had on American acting, theater, and movies?
Well, I think, for example, just one aspect, there's a man named Jack Gottlieb who wrote a book called Funny, It Doesn't Sound Jewish, and it's all about popular songs. Now, of course, you'd expect it from Irving Berlin, but Cole Porter, who was, you know, born in Indiana and who had absolutely no connection with Jews at all when he was growing up, but later on said to Richard Rodgers, I know how to write hit tunes. And Rodgers thought that was rather miraculous and said, how are you going to do that? And he said, I'll write him Jewish, by which he meant the kind of mournful tone that you sometimes hear in a song like, it'd be so nice to come home to. It's that kind of violin sound. And so I think that emanated from the Yiddish theater, those kinds of songs. And I once saw a master class that Casals was teaching, Pablo Casals, the cellist. And he was playing Bach's unaccompanied partita wonderfully, and then his student did it. And my ear is not good enough. It sounded to me as if the student was wonderful, and Casals said, no, 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 no. And he made him do it again. No, no. And finally he said, no, no, make more Jewish, by which he meant give that lamentation that you see in the Yiddish theater, that you hear in Jewish music. So I think that was a very strong influence, and of course later on seen in Leonard Bernstein and all the popular songwriters from Gershwin and Stephen Sondheim, all of them show this. And then in the theater itself, the serious theater, once you've experienced something like Paul Muni in, say, Scarface, which so profoundly influenced Al Pacino that, you know, 40 years later he demanded that to be in a remake. He said it was almost surrealistic, that kind of acting. It was so powerful. Then you know that that the Yiddish Theater threw a long shadow over every living actor.
Well, Stephen Kampfer, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure, always.
Stephen Kampfer is the author of Stardust Lost, The Triumph, Tragedy, and Mishegas of the Yiddish Theater in America. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.